Hello, I'm Richard Blanco and welcome to Inside Property. In the studio with me is the esteemed Chris Morris, Policy Director for the National Landlords Association, and award-winning journalist Sarah Davidson from This Is Money and The Mail Online. Now, this programme is the first of a new format where our aim is to pore over some topical housing issues. We're hoping to get through four during the course of the programme, and I wanted to pick up on recent political events to start off with. The Queen's speech comes to mind because there are a couple of things in there that do affect certainly the private housing sector. Now, of course, recent political events in the UK have been very eventful. We've had a sort of Greek tragedy that was Theresa May's spontaneous 2017 election. And we'll look at the election manifestos a bit as well and just reflect on those. Your thoughts, Sarah, on, you know, the election and the aftermath? Just give us a flavour of that to start off with.
I think, in a word, chaos, probably. We saw, as per usual, housing taking quite a central role in each party's manifesto pledges. All of that within the backdrop of the Tory government having just delivered its housing white paper with a lot of proposals outlining the problems that they have seen in the market. And I think the general consensus is that after the election, having a much smaller majority, or not a majority in the Commons at all, that much of that might get kicked into the long grass. So I think that that's not necessarily great news for the housing market.
Well, we did see a couple of things in the Queen's speech that are of interest to property professionals, didn't we, Chris? The banning letting agents' fees, which has been around for a while, of course. But the surprise, or at least I think it was a surprise, of deposits being capped.
It was a bit of a shock. I mean, we saw some speculation earlier on before the election with the consultation that took place with the proposal to ban fees that the government might look at deposits. I think really if you look at it in the context of the election and that long grass that Sarah mentioned that I think frankly is starting to grow through the cracks in Parliament as well, it's encroaching on the government. They've got very, very few options about what they can do. They desperately want to appeal to another demographic. So they're aware of how many households are renting. They're aware that people aren't satisfied. But they don't seem confident in their own policies. So they're trying to pick things like deposits, like fees, that they think they can chip away at the edges. And appeal to that wider part of the electorate. What effect it'll have? I mean, it's a really, really marginal proposal. It's not going to be popular with landlords by any stretch of the imagination because it's another intervention. It's another way their hands are tied. But if you look at what deposits are actually worth as part of that transaction, yes, almost half of landlords ask for more than 1 month's deposit and the proposal is to cap at 1 month. But when you look at how much they're actually asking for, they're asking for less than 5 weeks on average. So we're taking, you know, the equivalent of 1 week's rent back out of the equation. But when you've got £2,000, £3,000 or £4,000 move-in costs, is that 1 week's rent really going to make all the difference that the government wants to? And I'm really not sure.
My gut instinct on this is that more than 1 month is important because of that psychological issue. I think this has happened to lots of landlords where a tenant has decided not to pay the last month's rent because they know that the landlord's holding a month's deposit. And of course, that's not the idea. The month's deposit there is to pay off any damage or to pay for any damage. So 5 weeks, it seems to me, is psychologically important. And, you know, I hope that if there is a cap, it will get settled on at 5 weeks. Do you think there's much hope of that, Chris?
Well, I think you're right. There is a psychological element to how much you ask for a deposit. And the advice we at the NLA always give is whatever amount you pick on, do not make it a multiple of a month's rent, because people do exactly as you suggested there. They think that, you know, I've paid that much rent up front, therefore I don't need to pay my last month. And I leave, I move on, and that's the end of it. And as you quite rightly suggest, if there are damages, if there are other arrears, the landlord's then got very little recourse. So, you know, a landlord setting the deposit or the deposit they're going to ask to reserve should always think about it in terms of the protection I need rather than how much is it in equivalent to the deposit. I don't think the government will want to move on this at the moment because it'll be very easy for them to say it's a divisible of the annual rent. I mean, the way traditionally you look at these things, you look at 1/12 or 1/6 of the annual rent, and it's a nice, easy way for them to set it. If they look at it logically and they listen to the NLA and others, well, frankly, if they listen to the NLA, they won't impose a cap. But if they do, they need to make sure that it's separate from that monthly rental.
Sarah, do you think this is more evidence? I might be accused of asking you a leading question again here, actually, of the government just not understanding the business of being a landlord by setting that 1 month figure, or, you know, are they just being on the side of consumers here? And is there an appetite for this?
I think you used a really interesting word, which was psychology. I don't think that the government here is really concerned with landlords' business models at all. I don't think that that's the driving factor behind this sort of decision. It's populist. It's going to appeal to the very voters who they're currently not appealing to. They're trying to take... This is a land grab from Labour's home ground, young people, who are the people who are renting. And I think that 1 month is a psychological number for the tenant, from the tenant's perspective. I completely... hear what you're saying in terms of the practicalities of it, but I don't think that's what's motivating the government at all. And actually, I think we talked about the housing white paper earlier. There are a lot of proposals in there to address the shortage of housing and actually, you know, building more homes, which will help to ease a lot of these pressures from a more macro perspective. I don't think that they're going to deliver on that. I think that they're going to focus on these short-term vote-winning policies that they can express in a sentence and people can see a very tangible result. So it's a politically motivated decision, I would say.
I think that's a really interesting point. And if I can just come in briefly on that, I think what's been really interesting for us to look at this is it's described as consumer protection. The watchword for the government at the moment is consumer protection. We'll do whatever we can to make sure the most vulnerable are protected. When I look at what a deposit is actually for, I don't see it as a barrier to accessing housing. I see it actually as the lever that allows people to get into housing. And the reason, by and large, that a landlord will ask for more than that 1 month, whether they ask for 6 weeks or 8 weeks rent, is because there's another risk factor. It might be a vulnerability, it might be an unknown. So, for instance, if you're coming out of social housing, you need to get accommodation in the PRS, you probably won't have a track record. You won't be able to be vetted in the same way that an established private tenant would. A landlord there for that first year might well ask for a higher deposit to offset any potential risks. You know, if you've got particular vulnerabilities, if you need adaptations, something as simple as wanting a pet, for instance, or wanting to bring your family pet with you, the landlord might ask for a larger deposit. So whilst the government are talking about consumer protection, it seems to me that they've missed the very point, the very purpose of consumer protection, that you start with the most vulnerable and you explode that outwards. They seem to have started with maybe the middle of the market, said, isn't it a bit of a shame that you have to pay a few £100 extra when it's more than a month? Let's cap that, without actually thinking what it will do to the bottom end of the market. And if you ban deposits, the alternative for that landlord is to either find some kind of insurance. Now, some of those products exist, but they don't all look great for the tenant because it's insurance and no insurance company wants to pay out. Or you ask for a lot more rent up front. Now, I would say, you know, looking at it purely logically, it'll be easier to find 6 weeks rent as a deposit than it would be to find 3 or 6 months rent up front, which is the alternative if you can't find, say, a guarantor or some other way to mitigate your risk.
Another issue with the insurance-based alternative as well is that the tenant is not stumping up a chunk of money that then, you know, from a landlord's perspective, you feel like they're therefore going to look after the property because they, you know, that the Absolutely. Deposit's at risk, I guess, and that's the whole idea of it, isn't it? What about with banning letting agent fees? I mean, we still don't know what the shape of this is going to be. I'm one of those landlords who thinks, actually, fair enough, I pay an agent 8% of the annual contract to find me a tenant. Why should the tenant have to pay anything? So I'm kind of sort of in favour of this, really. What are you picking up from people, Sarah?
I broadly agree with you. I think that when Philip Hammond announced this as an idea in the autumn statement, there was a lot of knee-jerk reaction, actually branding this policy as a knee-jerk policy, interestingly, saying, you know, these are costs that are just going to get passed straight back to tenants in the form of higher rents. I think the danger that you've got if you scrap all letting agent fees is that their costs that they have to bear as businesses are going to rise. And you've seen share prices of all the big letting agency businesses fall on the back of that announcement. They're going to have to, especially if they're publicly listed, recoup that profit from somewhere So that's why the cost is it going to end up being passed back through to tenants in the form of higher rents. I don't think it should be. I think that actually we need to address the structural issue there. Letting agents are not as heavily regulated as they might be. I think there is also, you know, a responsibility on any business to charge fair and appropriate cost according to their expense. And I'm not sure that that's, I think that's the issue here. And it's not all letting agents that do charge outrageous fees. It's the ones that do that need to be brought back into line with a fair practice.
See, I always think, it'd be interesting to hear what you think about this, Chris. This idea of rents being forced up implies that there's no market forces there affecting rents. And, you know, the idea that I could just put up my rent to cover extra costs, I think it feels like a bit of a myth. And also, you know, are we not seeing structural changes in the letting agency business where we've got more online providers that's going to put pressure on high street agents not to put prices up?
Certainly. I mean, when it comes to rent setting, you know, it's very, very difficult to distill the economics of how you set the price for any particular product into one component. So if a landlord's cost base goes up, of course, what they charge to their customers, their clients, the tenants in this case, will over time go up. Do I think we'll see an enormous knee-jerk reaction to being charged an extra percent by the letting agent into rent? No, probably not. If you factor in all of the various interventions and particularly tax policies that landlords are facing at the moment, I think we will see an uplift in rents because of that. And it'll be very difficult to tell which bit is which. I think when it comes to the letting agent fee ban, and you could say similar, frankly, to the proposed cap on deposits, the government are really missing a trick. You know, they've identified certain areas that they can attack, like letting agents, to a certain extent like landlords, where there isn't going to be a great deal of sympathy. But they're picking pieces off. They're not looking at the whole structure of the system. And I would agree entirely, there's lots of things that letting agents are doing, or the way that they manipulate, their practices manipulate certain markets, that aren't right. So rather than look at, you know, what do we need in the private rented sector? What function do we need landlords and letting agents to perform? And then creating a system that it works within, we're scrubbing off symptoms and not really getting to the root cause of the problems.
Well, casting our minds back now at the manifestos in the election, of course, the spectre of compulsory three-year tenancies is around again, although the word compulsory wasn't really used in any of the manifestos. I think the strongest it got was the idea of it being a norm. And, of course, one of the issues here is landlords are kind of blamed for not giving tenants security of tenure, and yet we know the average tenancy lasts for 4 years. And actually, it's letting agents who benefit from churn, not landlords. And many landlords want tenants to stay as long as possible. I've picked off one of the things that was in the manifesto. Any other things that stood out for you, Sarah?
Well, I think the Tory manifesto largely reiterated what they've been saying for a while. So there were no real surprises there for me. But the Labour manifesto, one of the more radical proposals was right to buy being extended to private landlords under a Labour government. I have no idea how you would enforce that. It just seems completely, you know, off the wall to me in terms of how many other laws we have in this country that it would violate. But I think in terms of a mindset, that was a really interesting articulation of how younger people who are renting privately feel about home ownership and about their inability to get onto the property ladder. And there's a huge amount of it's not fair. I think Chris's point actually was a valid one, that the government, in fact all political parties, have a responsibility to run this country and create a future for our children that is one that we're all happy to leave behind. I don't think that sort of taking a step back and saying, look, this is the housing market as it is. This is where we want the housing market to be. How do we get there? And let's work back from that objective. I think, as you say, quite rightly, they just choose easy wins and they chip, chip, chip. And all of these things have unintended consequences. And I mean, it really is a mishmash. One of the things we've not talked about yet, but which I think we'll probably come on to, is social housing and how that fits into this picture, and it's something that was largely ignored by the political parties, other than Jeremy Corbyn, who did say that he promised to build, I can't remember what exactly, it was like a million new social houses. But I do think that that's a really important area of the market that the government is just ignoring, and it is piling immense pressure on the private rented sector, and that connection has not been made by any of the political parties, really.
Chris, I thought the manifestos were a bit thin. There wasn't very much in them. In some ways, I was pleased because, you know, no one was coming up with bonkers ideas. Mm. I did get some chuckles at landlord meetings from some of those rent to own or right to buy sort of proposals. And in fact, the Labour Party manifesto was probably more favourable towards the private rented sector than the 2015 one was, wasn't it?
There were a few elements in there. There were a few little giveaways. There were some tax incentives when it comes to energy efficiency. And some softer language than we saw last time around. But the fascinating thing with party manifestos is, in my opinion at least, not what's in them, it's what's missed out. And I think what the Conservatives got wrong across the board was some of the things they included. What's interesting for me when it comes to housing, particularly in Labour, is what was missed out. Because we, as an association, spend a lot of time talking to politicians on all sides, and we know what people would like to see, what they think there are barriers to. And very little of that came across in any of the party manifestos. So, I mean, you mentioned longer term tenancies. I mean, that's one thing that across the board, all of the political parties want to see. There's a varying degree of realism or optimism, perhaps, about how much could be done almost overnight in legislative terms and how much they've got to nudge behaviour before you get to a position where you might see that. But it comes back to that point we mentioned earlier, it's the psychology. It's how much are they prepared to engage with the psychology of the sector and the households who are living there to actually to perhaps correct people's assumptions about the security they've got or the security they're giving. Because we know that most landlords who do want a long-term tenancy in the way you say they want people to stay put don't think there's a problem at all in a periodic tenancy that has no reason to end. Whereas we know when you talk to a cohort of tenants on the other side of that equation, they have completely the opposite view. You know, they don't have the belief that they couldn't or wouldn't be kicked out at a moment's notice. So rather than looking at it from a party political and a statutory point of view, I think there's a lot of consideration now about how we can nudge behaviour. And that's the kind of thing that doesn't really come through in the manifestos.
And do you think that property professionals, I'm thinking landlords and agents, would have as much to fear from a Jeremy Corbyn government as perhaps people thought? I mean, we're seeing Theresa May's power ebbing away, and no one knows how long she'll be PM. What do you think?
Oh, I think it's really interesting because Jeremy Corbyn, even long before coming to power, coming to the head of the Labour Party, had a real interest in renting. I mean, almost every year, Jeremy Corbyn tabled a private member's bill to very heavily regulate the private rented sector. He was a backbencher. He wasn't a very popular backbencher within his own party, so they didn't get very far. But every year, the NLA would meet with Jeremy Corbyn to discuss his proposals. And he's a charming man, and we'd discuss what he wanted to do. He's very principled. He wasn't in the slightest bit pragmatic, didn't want to hear our side of the story. He was very polite and listened, but didn't want to hear our part of the story. So I suppose from my point of view, I'd be confident that if he were elected with a substantial majority, it wouldn't be a consultative exercise. I think we would see exactly what he and his colleagues have wanted to see for a number of years, which would be, I don't like the rhetoric of shifting back to the 70s, but a system more akin to the pre-1988 world, so more akin to the regulated tenancy. What's really the unknown in that is how much of the slack can be picked up by the social sector. Because I think you can introduce a policy like that that would undoubtedly reduce investment in the private housing if you've got somewhere for people to go. If you do that in isolation and you pick up the narrative that politicians have talked about for the last few years, which is there's just one rented sector, doesn't matter if it's social or private or where the money for the rent is coming from, it's all renting, which has some merits but misses an awful lot of the fine detail and the motivations. If you don't reintroduce that element of social housing, then there's a lot of things to fear, quite frankly. But I would say there's quite a lot for landlords to be worried about with the current system as well.
Yes. Well, of course, we don't have to look far just north of the border, really, to Scotland, to see what might be the implications of lifelong tenancies, which is in effect what's going to be coming in there. You're listening to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco, Chris Norris from the National Landlords Association, and Sarah Davidson from This Is Money and The Mail Online. Now, have you seen the latest BBC show on private renting? It's called The Week the Landlords Moved In, and episode 2 is airing the same week that we're recording this programme. What were your responses to the first episode, Sarah?
I think it was a real eye-opener for me in terms of the disconnect between the life lived by landlords and the life lived by those tenants that they chose to feature in the programme. So just to recap for those people who haven't seen it, it was a father and son landlord team went and spent a week in one of their tenants' homes. She was 66, working three jobs still to pay the rent, and living in absolutely horrendous conditions. Broken cooker, mold climbing up the walls, you know, not able to pay her energy bills to heat her flat properly because the rent had gone up. And I think that as an illustration of what can go wrong in the rented sector was really powerful. That said, I also think that's not the norm in the rented sector. I rent. I live in a beautiful house for not that much more money than she was paying in the middle of London. So I think that there is a, like Chris was saying earlier, I think that there's a job to do to correct how people see the private rented sector, and programmes like this actually don't do much to help that image of greedy landlords and poor vulnerable tenants being taken advantage of. So one thing I would say was that the both sets of landlords that went and lived in those houses did make positive changes for their tenants. The lady in the example I gave first, she was too scared to report the damage in her house because she felt that she was, given she was on a rolling contract by that stage, that she was going to be kicked out. It just highlights a lot of the issues faced by this sector. So.
And the other case was Paul Preston and his partner Priya, whom he calls Queen P. Paul's also a property mentor as well for people who are interested in buying and running HMOs, houses in multiple occupation. And he went to live in one of the rooms in one of his HMOs. Now, you know, we saw lots of mould. We saw rats as well, didn't we, in the HMO?
Awful.
Was this just rolling out the cliches again, did you think, Chris?
I mean, I think it was an interesting programme, and I don't disagree at all with what Sarah said there about how unhelpful it can be to identify certain instances. We've got to view it through the lens of what it was. It was an entertainment programme, so they've picked some stories that people will, enjoy is the wrong word, but people will engage with and watch and find interesting. I think what it showed me was you've got people who are trying to do things right, but are complacent. I mean, I wasn't actually particularly shocked with what I saw in terms of the conditions there. It looked like the result of people thinking they're doing things right, but not actually paying the attention they need to their investments. I mean, when it comes to the older lady,
Linda,
in very poor conditions, that flat looked awful. But what it was actually a side effect of was how insufficient her income had become because of a whole series of things, not solely because the rent was at a certain level. I mean, I happen to know the area.
Chadwell Heath, wasn't it?
I lived in Chadwell Heath for a number of years, and I rent a flat in Chadwell Heath, or I let a flat in Chadwell Heath. It wasn't an extortionate rent for the area, but what came back time and time again was her benefits weren't covering her rent. She was having to top up. She was having to work three jobs, and she couldn't afford to heat the property. Now, if you can't afford to heat somewhere and you're living there, and you're cooking and you're drying clothes, you're going to encounter mould. Now, what the landlords got really, really wrong in that situation was they put in a fix. They put in a kind of extraction system to try and fix the mould, and they never checked on it. They never called the lady back to say, has that solution worked? Has it fixed things? Do we need to do any more repairs? They assumed that it was all okay because she didn't tell them anything. And it comes back to that psychology again that we've mentioned time and time again. They assumed that if something was wrong, she would tell them, and they would fix it.
Well, there was a complete absence of periodic inspections, wasn't there? No, it sounds boring and technical, but and of course the TV company had chosen a property that the landlord hadn't been into for 18 months.
And so it was exactly the same problem in the other property. Now, the gentleman there in Milton Keynes with the HMOs, there was a certain irony that he really pitched himself as the ultimate professional landlord. And I'm sure his business is run impeccably in most respects, but he'd forgotten the human element. He'd forgotten to actually go round to or send someone round to each of those properties and check the... I mean, you mentioned the rats. There were rats there for a really silly reason. The door had fallen off the bin cupboard, so they were keeping bin bags indoors. Had somebody... OK, someone could have reported that, but we know for all different reasons people don't. Had somebody inspected that property that quarter, they'd have seen what was going on, they'd have reported it back. No landlord wants rats in their properties. He'd have had that fixed, as he did in the end of the programme, and moved on. So I think they'd both missed that human element, but there were lots more factors that I don't think that the programme picked up on, and probably wouldn't have been that interesting for an audience to watch.
There was a sort of bumbling unprofessionalism, wasn't there? And, you know, as an accredited landlord myself, I look at that and, you know, tear my hair out. And then I go to meetings with, you know, boroughs like Newham, and they talk about the sort of 75% of their landlords who are mediocre, who don't really do all the things that they should do. And so I begin to wonder, were those landlords fairly representative? And, you know, are accredited landlords like me quite rare? And is that one of the problems that we're facing?
I think that's the problem that the government thinks it wants to tackle, is that because of policy changes back in the 90s that allowed buy-to-let mortgages to be made available to individuals, made them much more affordable, among many other changes, which I'm sure Chris can outline, that encouraged sort of individuals with no experience in being a landlord into the sector, which is now largely dominated by smaller landlords. And not everyone is of the same standard. Not everyone knows what to do. Clearly, these people didn't realise they should be going around and inspecting their property. I did a roundtable with an insurance firm, landlord insurance firm, and they had done some research which found exactly that, which is something like 80% of people don't bother to check. And you think, you're viewing this very much as a financial transaction, and the houses are assets with capital value and an income, you know, they're income generating for you, without realizing that there is that element of social responsibility. You know, you're providing a service for a person, and it's the most basic service that anyone needs, is a roof over their head. So I do think that it raised questions for me about the professionalization of the sector. The flip side to that, which is what the government wants to see, is more institutional landlords coming into the sector, taking over from smaller scale landlords funded by buy-to-let. I'm not sure that that really is going to address the problem either. I think this is about living conditions and basic standards, and that actually maybe a more helpful thing to do would be to make inspections mandatory once every 6 months for all landlords, regardless of their size. But then, I mean, you know, I was thinking about this earlier, anecdotally. Public loos in motorway service stations are inspected once every hour for cleanliness. And we can't inspect someone's house more than once every 18 months. That is shocking.
Okay, yes, I guess it's the issue of compulsion, isn't it? I mean, I picked up on quite a lot of phrases in here in the show that I thought parodied landlords. Like at one point, a landlord said his strategy was let it and forget it, buy low, rent high. We buy one property for one reason only, and that is to make money. We saw people playing golf, lots of expensive shoes and handbags and fast cars. Do you think it was unfairly biased, Chris?
I think it was a TV programme made to attract an audience to watch the TV programme. If it had identified a whole series of NLA accredited landlords who go about doing things properly, who have tenants who are perfectly happy, I probably wouldn't have watched it. And I spend my life working with those people. I think Sarah hit the nail on the head. There's been a lot of encouragement to get people to invest. And there's been lots of other factors making other investments not look particularly good or particularly appealing. But there hasn't been the same encouragement to get the accreditation, to get the training. I mean, if you look at what the NLA does in terms of its accreditation, we look solely at the management standards. So we can be criticised that there isn't an inspection, But we take it from the point of view that if you've bought a property, you've done the investment bit. You're probably familiar with that. What you really need to make sure you do is the management piece afterwards, the much longer running piece that arguably to everyone else is much, much more important. So I'd focus on that. I mean, they picked up on lots of stereotypes. Of course, they did. Some of them are there for perfectly good reason. I think most of the time you've got people doing things very, very well. But the investment piece is key there. You've now got an estimated 2.3 million landlords in the UK. If 99% of them are doing everything perfectly, there's still more than 23,000 people not getting it quite right. So that we've just reached a point where the PRS is at such a scale that you will identify people like this. If, you know, 10 years ago when I started working with the NLA, we had half that many landlords. You know, reading it all back, half as many rogues, presumably, to use that horrible term again. So the numbers are escalating, just the way we deal with it's got to change.
And of course, it was, you know, pretty heart-wrenching seeing that dilemma of Linda's, where she either had to pay her rent or her heating. And it made me think that, you know, years ago she might well have been in social housing, of course, but, you know, it's an area that's been shrinking. I want to bring us on finally to the issue of Grenfell, which, of course, looms large at the moment in terms of social housing and the future of social housing. This extraordinary catastrophe in North Kensington with at least 80 fatalities and maybe more, of course. And this was a housing project, I guess, a tower block that is in North Kensington, shoehorned between a motorway and several railway lines in that sort of northern tip of one of the UK's richest boroughs. All kinds of machinations going on. We don't know if the chair of the inquiry, Sir Martin Moore-Bick, is going to continue because there have been lots of calls for him to stand down. I'm interested in what we think might be the implications for social housing. What are your responses to the situation, Sarah?
I think it's a very difficult thing to talk about because obviously this is about the loss of human life. And the saddest thing about it for me is that it comes down to money. That ultimately a situation which might not have been perfect and which might, you know, there might have been a fire had this cheaper cladding not been used on the building. We don't know that there wouldn't have been, but that the decision to save money has exacerbated the dangers for human life. So I think that just goes to show, you know, it's not just private landlords perhaps that see property as a transactional situation and aren't necessarily thinking about those tenants. It's social landlords as well, local authorities. So I think if we could say that anything has come out of this that could be viewed as positive, it's definitely shone a light on how bad that dynamic has got in this country, that something really needs to be, we need to look at how we deal with that. One thing I would say as well is that you mentioned Linda there, you know, being catered for in the past by the social housing sector. And indeed, she had gone on to local housing allowance as part of her rent. I think that there is a big problem in this country in that because there's been so many changes and we've just gone through a 10-year recession or downturn, there isn't enough money. We've had austerity for a prolonged period of time. The skills that used to exist in the public sector to deal with housing aren't there anymore. You've got local or housing benefits switching into universal credit at the moment. That's going through the system. People don't really understand how that's going to work. It changes the way that money is handed from the council to the landlord or via the tenant, and whether it's a weekly payment or a monthly payment, and it involves budgeting. All of these things taken together with the changes in the buy-to-let market, tax with the rollback of tax relief, I think that we are creating a storm that is going to hit, and it's not just going to be private landlords. I think the people who are really going to suffer are people. They're the social tenants. And we're already seeing evidence of landlords pulling back from housing social tenants, but also people who perhaps are vulnerable, aren't able to keep up with their rent, even with universal credit. And landlords, I think, can apply for a thing called an APA. I can't remember what that stands for.
An alternative payment arrangement, yeah.
Yeah, whether DWP will pay that benefit directly to the landlord. to try and help ease some of those problems, but the DWP doesn't have the resource or the skill or the knowledge to actually make those changes, you know, to affect that. And so there are these huge gaps in rents. Landlords, meanwhile, are going into arrears. They're worrying about their tenants going not paying. I think this is just, I mean, to me, the whole catastrophe and disaster at Grenfell highlights that there are just so many problems in this area. And I really hope that it's the catalyst that gets politicians to make some real change to help those people in those situations.
Chris, looking at some of the technical aspects of this, I mean, here we had a tower block that was refurbished in accordance with fire regulations that appeared to permit some combustibility in cladding. I mean, we have to wait, of course, to see what the inquiry says. We've also seen Camden evacuate some of its blocks because of the absence of fire doors. What's going on in terms of regulation?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, obviously, you know, to echo exactly what Sarah said, there's been a tragic event here, and we don't know exactly what happened, and we don't know what the outcome of these various inquiries will be, or exactly what happened on the night. Building regulations are a very complex beast. You comply with them on the day that you carry out the work. So we have these blocks that were built in the 1970s or before, when building regulations said, you know, it was permissible to have no sprinkler systems. I believe it's still permissible to have one stairwell, but they're based on certain advice and a certain process to create something that should be safe. I mean, I think if there's a positive that comes out of this tragic event now, it will be that it will shine a light on the process. We know that many aspects of these building regs have been overdue for review for a number of years, and the succession of housing ministers and housing and planning ministers we've had have put it on the back burner. I know personally that DCLG are taking it very seriously now, because I'm attending a roundtable tomorrow with the Secretary of State to discuss this. And we're, as an organisation, not directly involved, but they want to get input from as many people as they can. I think if we reflect this onto the private rented sector, I think what it's done, I mean, all of those points about funding are absolutely true. I think what it's done in a very practical sense now has raised a lot of questions about a lot of the works that landlords, private landlords, have been encouraged to do for the last few years to comply with energy efficiency. We've been given very, very short timescales to insulate properties. And, you know, we're getting a lot of questions raised of our members about, you know, on a very, very low-rise scale, conventional traditional houses or smaller blocks, you know, are they safe? And it means those questions are cascading through all types of property. And we're going to have to see a major, major review.
I've seen some elements of political opportunism around what's happened. For example, I was at a meeting at London Borough of Newham this week, where they're hoping to bring in borough-wide selective licensing again for a further 5 years. And of course, the decision lies with the Secretary of State now, because it's more than 20% of the borough. And they're thinking that because of, you know, the current climate around regulation, the government will rule in their favour. I mean, are we likely to see more stringent rules for the private rented sector, or will the spotlight go off the private rented sector onto social housing for a while?
When it comes to building regs and safety, it tends to be cross-tenure. My hope would be that we look at safety and we look at building regulations across the piece. I mean, you don't have one set of building regulation for private housing versus one set for social housing. There are different standards for different parts of property, but it doesn't tend to get down to the granularity of safety. You've either got a building that meets regulations or not. So I think this will be something that just works across the piece. What this will do, and particularly in the context of the government that we've got now and the exit from the EU that we've got, there's very little parliamentary time to do these things. And we've got to ask the question about what's going to be dropped. There's an awful lot of welfare reform. There's all the conversation about austerity. There are at least 8 pieces of primary legislation at my last count for Brexit, and about 400 more that need to follow. And now there's this incredibly important safety piece. So I think there's going to be a lot of questions asked about what comes first and what do we need to do now.
And I've had tenants asking me about their fire alarms and how do you test them, and I've been helping them test them, and I'm doing a periodic inspection on Friday, and I will be now testing smoke alarms as part of that, which I haven't necessarily done in the past. So I think it's made all of us think a lot more about this stuff. Now, Sarah, in the past, you've despaired at the turnover of housing ministers. And here we are with yet another.
Yep.
I think it might be number seven, is it? No, number six since 2010. We've yet to have a woman housing minister as well, I was thinking the other day as well.
Oh, we have in the past. So if you go back to 2000, or 1997, I think we had Yvette Cooper.
We've had Yvette. Margaret Beckett was Minister of State.
Oh, I stand corrected. Okay.
Yeah.
I read that somewhere, so that was wrong.
There's not been a Conservative female housing minister.
Okay, maybe it was that, yes. But we've got Alok Sharma now, MP for Reading West, an accountant. He's been on the Treasury Select and Science Committee. Are you enthused by his appointment, Sarah?
Look, it's not his fault. I think we should acknowledge that. And I also think that had Gavin Barwell not lost his seat, he would still be in place. I don't think that they would have dared to change another housing minister. So in that sense, it's nobody's fault, really. I don't think that the government can be blamed other than for the decision to call a snap election. On that count. However, he's going to have a big job. Look, this is not straightforward at all. There are so many moving parts. You do one thing to correct something over here and you cause a whole load of problems over there. We don't have a housing crisis in this country because it's easy and people are not thinking about it. We have one because it's a really hard problem to solve and there's not one easy answer. I think the danger is that he takes 6 months to get himself up to speed, which is realistic and if not speedy by anyone's standards. And at that stage, you know, starts to try and do something. I think until he's up to speed with the issues, we're not going to see anything on the housing white paper, by which point maybe people will be like, oh, well, maybe this isn't quite such a big priority. I don't know.
It must be really frustrating for you, Chris, because obviously you need to have a positive, constructive relationship with housing ministers. But if, as Sarah's taking, it's taking them 6 months to get up to speed, then, you know, then they're gone within another 6 months.
Yeah. when Mr. Sharma was appointed, I counted all of the housing ministers, or at least the ministers with responsibility for the PRS that I've known in my time at the NLA, and there've been 13 of them. So we've had quite a few.
It's seen as this political stepping stone, isn't it, on the way to somewhere, not as a job in its own right.
And it can also make and break people. I mean, we've had some very, very poor ministers over the last few years and some who've meant well. I mean, I think it's far too soon to know what the latest incumbent will do. The only advice, frankly, we could give them is to take that time to get to know your brief and not react, try to do something because something must be done. Some of the worst policies, consultations, proposals we've seen have just been knee-jerk reactions at things that they've perceived to be an issue. I think once they consider it a little bit more, and particularly with all the pressures that we've discussed already, if they can pick areas where they want to achieve something, they've actually got a sector that wants to work with them.
Desperately wants to work
Absolutely.
With them. I think the government actually has... Or Theresa May, she has an opportunity, which so far she's not taken, and I'm not sure she will, but to make the housing minister position a cabinet seat in its own right. That would give it more clout. It would prevent ambitious ministers taking that post only to be moved on to something bigger and better for their career. I'm not sure how realistic that is, but I think that would help the situation. The problem is housing policy sounds great and no one ever has to deliver on it because you're out of power by the time the cookie crumbles. So,
if you recall, the housing minister did sit in cabinet up until 2010,
Absolutely.
When there was quite a fraw with one of those female ministers, Caroline Flint resigning in a very high profile way, saying she didn't want to be window dressing anymore and didn't think there was any role for her as that minister at that time in the cabinet.
Okay, well, lots of food for thought there, but that's it for this programme. We've run out of time. I want to mention that the week the landlords moved in continues on BBC One on Wednesdays at 9 p.m. throughout July 2017 and is also available on BBC iPlayer. And there's a link to the programme on our website. If you'd like to get in touch with us and for useful links, please do go to insideproperty.org.uk. My thanks to Chris Norris and Sarah Davidson and to you for listening. And the programme is produced in collaboration with the National Landlords Association.